Okay, the Civil Justice Committee will come to order, and there is a quorum, and first, we'll take them in this order. The House Files 534, 731, 292, and whatever the other, 722, and but first, Representative Mahoney asked for a couple minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yesterday, I was made aware the Senate's not going to hear House, I don't know what the Senate file is, 10, but House File 1003. So my intention is not to bring it up off the table. But since the hearing last week, I've been contacted by more than 100 people that wanted to testify and a half a dozen lawyers that wanted to come in and answer some of the testimony. So when this comes back up next year, as the Senate is planning on hearing family bills next year, I would ask that you plan on a very long hearing.
Thank you.
Very long hearing.
For the warning. But thank you for also not bringing it back since it's not going anywhere and we're in time crunch. Mr. Chair. Representative Wester.
Mr. Chair, just on that issue, Representative Mahoney, sorry to hear that fate at this point, but I think you've maybe gotten my emails, but I know I had a couple keenly interested constituents that were disappointed they couldn't have been here to testify as well. So
I think
that 100 could be larger than that.
Okay. The first bill on the calendar for today is House File 534, Representative Davids. I will bring that back up. We laid it over before, so I'll bring it back up in front of us. And Representative David, it's my understanding that we've agreed on an A5 amendment. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If that's correct, there should be an amendment being passed out with the language that was worked out.
Mr. Representative David, I think isn't that the A5? Is there an
I have an A5 amendment that I'd...
I think they already have it.
No, I think this is Mallory's.
Oh, that's a different amendment. That's for Nick Bill, Representative Davis.
Oh, okay.
I don't think you want the slave trafficking in your bill.
It's going to greatly expand the scope of my bill.
You might run into a problem in court on the one subject.
Mr. Chairman, if you should get us a copy of the amendment.
Representative David, somebody... Mr. Stone's giving you a copy, and I will move the A5 amendment to get it in the shape the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carried. Representative Davids, I think that this clears up the issue we were talking about so that it's clear that a third party relying on a certificate does still have the ability to rely on that. And I've talked to Mr. Spassetto, and I think everybody's agreed on this language. Is there any questions on this? Okay, if there's no questions, we'll just vote on it then. All in favor, this was directly to the floor. Yes. You don't remember who made the motion? I made the motion originally. Okay.
Chair, are we voting on the amendment or the bill?
We already voted on the amendment.
Thank you,
the motion. So the motion is to pass. I'm sorry. Representative
Mahoney. Have 15 seconds to explain the bill again. I mean,
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Dominic Spazzetto representing the Independent Insurance Agents Association of Minnesota. The bill itself puts in statute term certificate of insurance, which is basically a document that is given to third parties and others to prove that an entity has insurance. It prohibits an insurance agent from making any alterations to that certificate that would affect the underlying policy. Keep in mind, the certificate of insurance is just basically proof that you have insurance at a certain period of time. All of the coverages and others are dictated by the policy. We got into a discussion last time of the agent's ability and authority to issue these certificates, and the wording of the bill was probably not very clear, so we changed the language on that to make it clear that the agent always does have the authority and the ability to issue documents that prove insurance. And then at the request of Representative Mallory and others, we put in an application saying that nothing in this particular legislation would affect the rights of a policyholder or a third party to rely on evidence of insurance that's provided by an insurance agent.
Very good. Thank you.
Everything in, okay. The motion again is to pass House File 534 and send it to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, member.
Next bill before us is House File 731. And Representative, well, first, Matt, what's the status?
Madam Chair, last time this bill was heard, there were two amendments that were offered. The first one was the A1 amendment that took out the minimum $20,000 damage award that's in the bill. As you may recall, that amendment was later reconsidered and taken off of the bill, but then Representative Portman offered an oral amendment to take out the $20,000 language again. So as the bill stands right now, the third sentence in paragraph A of the version of the bill as introduced, which contains the $20,000 minimum damage award, that has been removed from the bill. So the bill before the committee is the entire introduced version of the bill without the $20,000 minimum.
Okay. Is everyone on the committee clear about that? All right. Representative Mallory, would you like to move
the bill? Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would move Amendment A4 then to we listen to the people that were listening to the slave trafficking lobby, and we reduce the amounts so that it's $5,000 for a period of less than 1 month, $10,000 for less than 3 months, and $15,000 for less than 6 months, and then $20,000 for years after that. And basically, that is the bill. We've gone over the whole issue before. It was very interesting. Saturday night, I happened to turn on the TV, and it was I don't know if it was Law and Order, one of those programs that was on, came on whatever channel I had before, and it was on this exact issue and how kids were being brought from Africa and the West Indies and being basically kept as slaves in homes and doing work. And so I think this meets the objections that people thought $20,000 was too high if it was only a week or two or something like that.
Representative Mahoney, you've got a question regarding the amendment before we vote on it?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right.
It's not so much a question. I'm going to support the author and his amendment, and I'm going to support his bill. But by the time it gets to the House floor, I'd certainly love to see it, a base, pick the number, I don't really care, but I mean, I look at this and it kind of, my guess on a judge is going to go, well, I can't go over $5,000 because it was just a month, and any child, woman, man, human being that's held in slavery for a month, well, there's a few things I think should be done to the victimizer. But the victim should certainly make more than $5,000. But I'll just leave it at that and hope that between here and the floor, still keeps changing.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Mahoney. I agree with you, but there was problems within the committee on not believing that, and it does not limit it to $5,000. It clearly says the greater of actual damages. I happen to think you could show that there's more than $5,000 in actual damages on such a thing.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm sure Representative Mallory knows how much I trust the judicial system in this case.
Representative Mallory, then that's a minimum in effect, right?
Right. Okay. That's the minimum. Thank you for clarifying that, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I don't know. We've had a lot of testimony on the bill. I don't know that we really need any more.
Any other questions before we vote on the amendment? And all of those in favor of Amendment A4 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. All right, motion carries. To your bill as amended.
Well, Madam Chair, I think it's very important to get at this issue of human trafficking, and I think this helps get some solid basis into our law on the civil side of getting at this issue. And so I hope that we can pass it and get it going.
Members, any questions? Oh, and where is this bill headed next, Representative Miller?
I believe it goes to the floor, I thought.
General Register?
I think it goes to the General Register.
All right. Hearing none, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Miller, renew his motion.
Again, passage 731 to the General Register. As amended, I'm sorry. Thank you.
All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign.
Thank you, Madam Chair, member.
Thank you.
Representative Rook Savina, I saw you earlier.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, members. Does somebody want to move Representative?
Mr. Chair, I'll move.
Well, Representative Paymar was hit quicker with his hand. Representative Paymar moves House File 292 and
this
goes to public safety, I believe. So, Representative Paymar moves passage of 292 and re-referral to Public Safety Committee. Representative Rukavina, do you have a
yes, Mr.
A3
Chair.
Amendment?
Well, it says A2 on mine.
Is this a... That's the wrong... Representative Rukavina, yes, I was handed the wrong amendment. Representative Paymar, do you want to move A2?
Move the A2.
Representative moves the A2 amendment to get it in the shape the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Rukavina, now I believe the bill is in the form you want.
Mr. Chair, do the members want an explanation on the amendment? Or?
Well, I thought that would be part of your explanation
okay.
of the whole bill.
Okay. Well, just the amendment first, it increases the fee for a lost registration card and the employee fee from $10 to $15. It increases the fee for a registered organization from $1,000 to $2,000. And it puts a definition right in the statute, or the definition in statute right now of intractable pain. It references that right in the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm just going to have a quick presentation to you. I've been asked, you know, why am I carrying the bill? Well, I spent about the last 8 years in the nursing home with my aunt, who I was her legal guardian, and with my mother, and also at the end of my father's life, I watched him in a lot of pain, taking a lot of pills. In fact, I think my dad had 13 pills a day, and my mother was close behind. And so, you know, I just think that there's a better way for some folks to address their pain. And medical marijuana is right now legal in 13 other states. I think there's overwhelming public support. In fact, a 2005 Gallup poll showed 78% nationally support medical use of marijuana. In Minnesota this last fall, there was a poll done, actually it was kind of a push poll against it, and 60% of people still responded positively in support of it. The state of Michigan, which just passed it, I believe, by constitutional amendment in last year's election, there was 63% support and it passed in every county in the state, which is even more than Barack Obama got in Michigan for support. There's a number of different medical organizations and other organizations that support this bill, including here in Minnesota, the Minnesota Nurses Association. It's supported by the American College of Physicians, by the Minnesota Senior Federation. And to me, members, the bill is about a compassionate, inexpensive treatment for terminally and seriously ill patients. It's about a decision between a physician and his or her patient, and people who are, to me, who are sick and at the end of their lives, who have battled with a debilitating disease and have gotten no relief through conventional drugs, should be able to have some relief. So, members, there are a lot of regulations in this bill, and maybe you'll hear that there's not enough, but I believe that there is one of the toughest bills, if not the toughest bill, in the country regarding medical marijuana. So, with that, if I could, unless the committee has any questions at this particular time, I would like to have a few supporters come up and speak on behalf of the bill.
Representative Rusevina, could you have them come up quickly? Maybe two or three could come up and be ready. This is one of you, Joni Whiting, and one Heather Ozzie?
I can hear you, sir.
Is one of you Joni Whiting and one Heather Ozzie?
Heather's back there.
Oh.
That's
okay.
Joni. I'm Kathy.
Oh, okay.
Okay, I'm going first. Hi, everybody.
And
good morning.
Would you state your name?
It's Kathy Rippentrop.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Kathy Rippentrop, and I appreciate the opportunity to submit my testimony in support of the medical marijuana bill today. My mom, Jean Schmidt, was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer in November of 2003 and was given about 1 year to live. My mom went through many surgeries and many hospitals. She had a section of her colon removed and then the right half of her liver. A year later, they removed more of her liver and later part of her lung, part of her diaphragm, and a large glob of cancer that had wrapped around her main blood vessel that fed her lower torso. She also caught MRSA, a flesh-eating virus, while in the hospital, and recovering from each surgery became much more complicated. Mom tolerated the first series of chemo quite well. However, the pills she was prescribed for the vomiting cost $100 each. They were only about 75% effective and took 30 minutes to start working and were not covered by insurance. And they did nothing at all for her dwindling appetite. Another surgery and a second series of chemo took its toll. Mom was withering away to nothing with no appetite. She suffered serious stomach sickness and found it hard to stay in a positive frame of mind. That's when a friend of my dad suggested he buy a bag of marijuana. My dad is a recovering alcoholic and drug user, 30 years clean, and was highly reluctant to bring illegal substance into our house. But after watching Mom suffer for another few days, he had the friend procure some. My family will tell you that the only miracle drug for cancer is marijuana. Two puffs, 2 minutes, and the violent sickness is totally gone. An hour later, my mom was able to have a good meal. The stomach problems from the chemo were totally gone. It also helped her regain a quality of life that allowed her to continue to fight. It's always hard. Unless you're dying yourself, or very close to someone that is, it's extremely hard to imagine how depressing a debilitating illness can be. Dying is bad, but dying in sickness and pain is much worse.
My mom ended up living for 4.5 years. She would have never survived the second year without medical marijuana. With it, she was able to keep fighting, was even able to travel overseas before the end. In the 12 months before she died, she visited Israel, Jordan, Egypt, Mexico, Cuba, and Greece. These were all lifelong dreams that she was able to fulfill only because of medical marijuana. My father will tell you how ironic it is that the government should worry that a murderer might feel some pain, yet make the only good cancer drug against the law. He likes to say that when they or their spouse or their child has cancer, those that are so against it will become believers in a real hurry. When a loved one is suffering, you do whatever you can do to ease their pain. There's simply no reason that this safe, effective medicine should not be available to those who need it. I strongly urge the committee to support this compassionate legislation. There are a few pictures here of my mom. We're just a family like your family. And would we do this all over again? In a minute. In a minute.
Thank you, Ms. Rippentrop. Ms. Ozzie, is that correct?
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Joni Whiting.
Oh, sorry. Ms. Whiting, go ahead.
And I appreciate the opportunity to tell my story. However, I want to be clear from the outset. There's nothing being done here in this room today that will benefit my family or me. There is nothing that you can give to ease our pain. I will suffer the rest of my life for what I have lost. I am here today only to tell you about a woman I loved and lost 6 years ago. I ask only that you listen to her story, to walk just briefly in her shoes and mine. My daughter Stephanie was a wife, a loving mother of three, and a beloved employee of Dart Distributing. Stephanie had a unique and beautiful voice, the voice of an angel. In June of 2000, at the age of 24 years old, Stephanie was diagnosed with melanoma skin cancer on her face. A mole had gone bad during her pregnancy, her third pregnancy, but it was already too late. The next 2 years were filled with experimental therapies and endless surgeries as they cut her face off 1 inch at a time until there was nothing left to cut. There was nothing to put back to cover the hole in her face. All but 4 of her teeth had been removed due to the side effects of the chemotherapy. The skin graft had failed. It was difficult for her to eat. The nausea was so severe that the medications gave her little to no relief. A doctor at the hospital pulled me aside and told me that she may get some relief from smoking marijuana, but that wasn't an acceptable option for me or her being drug-free. In addition, the legal ramifications associated with illegal use were frightening to us. After her 10th surgery, all efforts to save her life had failed, and her oncologist predicted that she had about 6 months to live. At that time, she was taking approximately 40 to 50 tablets of OxyContin and 30 to 40 tablets of oxycodone per day. Yet her pain was still evident in her every breath and in her every movement. Her whole body was racked with continuous and uncontrollable pain, and her tumors continued to grow. There was nothing to stop it, nothing to slow it down, and the hope for a miracle faded as my child bravely began to make plans for the ending of her life. When Zofran, the anti-nausea drug, continued to give her no relief, Stephanie began to lose weight. We asked her doctor to prescribe Marinol, a synthetic version of THC, one of the active chemical compounds in marijuana. But even taking this in pill form didn't abate any of her symptoms, and she stopped taking it because it didn't work. As her tumors grew larger, it became more and more difficult for her to eat. They were growing inside and outside of her mouth, her throat, and her chest. My other adult children begged me to let her use marijuana, and when I refused, they took her out of my home. When she came back 3 days later, Stephanie told me she'd gotten hungry after using it, and that the marijuana had picked up her appetite, as well as allowed her to keep the food down. She had eaten 3 meals a day at a time when she'd routinely eaten nothing for days. She had just a touch of energy back, and she looked better than I had seen her in months. For reasons I don't know, marijuana also enhanced the effects of Stephanie's pain medication and didn't appear to make her high. My only regret is not allowing her to use marijuana in my home throughout her illness. Yet the fear of being caught was significant. I called a number of my family members and friends of our family and asked if they knew of anywhere we could purchase marijuana. The next morning, someone had placed a package of it on our doorstep. I have never known whom to thank for it, but I remain grateful beyond belief. I was prepared to defend my daughter's use to anyone who asked. In retrospect, I can tell you with conviction that I would have no problem going to jail for acquiring medical marijuana for my suffering child. The law is unjust. And I would rather spend the rest of my life in prison than have denied her the medicine that kept her pain at bay and allowed her to live 89 more days. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, quote, "I submit that an individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the conscience of the community over its injustice is in reality expressing the highest respect for the law. I'm here today to tell you that I am no longer willing to support making criminals out of the sick and dying. I saw with my own eyes that medical marijuana worked. I have dedicated a large portion of my own life to helping people stay clean and drug-free, and I see no contradiction of this at all. My daughter was able to eat for nearly 3 more months because of marijuana. I allowed her to use it in my home before meals because it worked and helped her. And every day of her life was precious to her and her 3 small children. We had Thanksgiving and Christmas with her at the table that year. Having her there was priceless. Shortly after Stephanie was placed on 24-hour nursing care and could no longer use medical marijuana, her pain was so severe that when she asked my husband and me to lie down on both sides of her and hold her, she couldn't stand the pain of us touching her body. She was on IV morphine and moaned in pain continuously. Her hospice nurses were so disturbed by the severity of her pain that they finally used IV lidocaine to numb her whole body. The morphine, even at the strongest dose allowed by law, wasn't giving her any relief. On January 14, 2003, at 1:30 in the morning, with her beloved children sleeping in their beds in the other rooms, Stephanie died in the room she grew up in, holding my hand. Her strong heart continued to beat for nearly 3 minutes. She was 26 years old. They say there's no greater loss than that of a child for a parent, and they're right. For this government to deny those who need medical marijuana to lessen the severity of their pain, nausea, and seizures is unjustifiable. To threaten the sick and dying and their loved ones with jail, unconscionable.
I'm a Vietnam veteran, and my youngest son has recently returned from 15 months in Iraq. We are a family that honors this country, having served it in the military in every conflict since the Revolutionary War. I don't use drugs. I don't abuse alcohol. I've raised four children. I'm currently raising the children my daughter had to leave behind. What would you have done had you been in my shoes? Could you sleep at night with your child screaming in pain? What price would you be willing to pay to relieve the suffering of someone you love? I was the one that listened to her screams. I was the one who saw everything she suffered. No human being should ever suffer again what my child suffered. My daughter and I were forced to break the law to ease the pain of a cruel and punishing illness. The fact is, you can't do anything for me. My daughter is dead. But there are others in similar situations right now in Minnesota. They deserve compassion, dignity, and honor, and mercy. You can provide some amount of relief to them by passing this bill. Thank you. I have pictures of my daughter as well. I have six, maybe two beside her. Thank you very much.
Representative Rufovino, we basically, do you want to wrap up real quick? Because we got to have equal time
for
the other
side,
and then there's probably discussion. Thank you, Representative Rufovino. Would Phil Prokopowicz and Michael Campion come down first from the opposing side? Commissioner Campion? And we'll try and even out the time for each side and save time for discussion on the panel of committee. Mr. Prokopowicz is listed first, so do you want to go ahead and we'll try and give you two about 8 minutes, and then we'll limit the rest a little, quite a bit more. Or do you want Commissioner Campion to go first?
Mr. Chair, if it pleases you, I would be very brief, and I'll go first, and I'll make a point of not repeating what others are going to repeat. Michael Campion's name, our Commissioner of Public Safety, here to testify in opposition to the bill. No disrespect to the author, talked to him before the hearing, of course, and told him that we were here to testify against the bill. This administration has been against it since the last 4 or 5 years for two specific reasons. One, from a health perspective, there really is an absence of any legitimate empirical data that this piece of legislation is going to do what it intends to do. There's a lot of anecdotal stories about it, but the American Medical Association, the FDA, other legitimate medical associations have not endorsed this piece of legislation or the smoking of marijuana for health purposes. But second, from a public safety standpoint, Mr. Prokopowicz is going to be more specific than I, but the bill is, I think, riddled with problems in terms of incentives for illegal distribution of marijuana. There's little regulation in the bill. It's literally impossible to enforce. But primarily, our opposition to the bill from a public safety standpoint is it is against federal law, and it puts the Minnesota's criminal justice system in conflict with our federal partners here in Minnesota. Not only law enforcement, but prosecutors, and I would even contend judges, in practice, would be in opposition with federal law, and that puts us in a very precarious position. And I am not just a petty bureaucrat here, a law enforcement person, screaming that the sky is falling because of marijuana. For this reason, I was in the narcotics enforcement business a large portion of my life, and I think some 20 years ago, this legislature took a very balanced approach in terms of marijuana. Most people probably don't know, but a small amount of marijuana is not a crime. Anything under an ounce and a half of marijuana is a petty misdemeanor, and a petty misdemeanor is not a crime. And that's, if you proposed, you would know, but that's well over 20 years ago. So I think we've taken a balanced approach here in terms of the enforcement of marijuana laws, and we have done well in Minnesota to decrease the use of marijuana from an education, treatment, and enforcement standpoint. If anybody thinks that this piece of legislation won't increase the use of marijuana throughout this, throughout our communities, I think you're frankly kidding yourself. And I don't think the people running around the state of Minnesota in any number of different professions with an increased use of marijuana is good for our communities. From a very practical standpoint, let me point out a couple of other problems that I think are contained in the bill. If there was some language in the bill, and I'm not even saying if this language existed, it would make a great deal of difference as far as this administration is concerned, but we constantly hear stories about end-of-life treatment. There is no language in this bill that intends to focus the or allow the use of smoking marijuana for end-of-life treatment. There's no language in there. It opens it up to anybody and everyone. I would point out that and I'm not a medical professional, obviously, but what has befuddled me over the last number of years is this intent to evade the Food and Drug Administration process that has served this country good for well over 100 years. Literally thousands and thousands and thousands of products that consumers have enjoyed in this country for well over 100 years have to be approved by the Food and Drug Administration. Not only food, but cosmetics and even food for our pets. Dog food and cat food have to be approved by the FDA. And this piece of legislation intends to skirt that issue or that process entirely. I think that there's probably a number of people on this committee that have known people in the past who have used Vioxx. And Vioxx was a product that was put out by Merck a number of years ago to medicate people who had joint problems. Vioxx was on the market and went through all of the scrutiny of the FDA for a number of years, all the clinical tests, on the market for a number of years. And the medical community found out that it had increased heart rates and had severe problems with heart problems. And the FDA pulled it off the market. And that's after the scrutiny of FDA. Yet this piece of legislation intends to allow marijuana to be smoked for all practical purposes without going through any process at all. So, Mr. Chair, I'll end my testimony, but that's our concerns from our perspective.
Prokopowicz, could you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Be fairly short, but
sure. My name is Phil Prokopowicz. I'm the Chief Deputy Dakota County Attorney. I've been a prosecutor for going on my 24th year now. I'm here representing the Minnesota Law Enforcement Coalition, which is a coalition made up of the following membership: the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, the Minnesota State Association of Narcotics Investigators, Minnesota Sheriff's Association, Minnesota Police Officers and Peace Officers Association, which are the major law enforcement associations in our state, and they all are opposed to this particular legislation. We'd ask you to do the same. We have issued a position paper, which I believe has been distributed to the memberships of this committee, outlining many of the public safety concerns regarding this particular bill, some of which have been highlighted by Commissioner Campion. I do want to point out just a couple of them that would be of particular interest for this particular committee, being the Civil Justice or Judiciary Committee of the House. Despite the assertions of the proponents of this bill lacks significant oversight ability by the Commission of Health and other state organizations. There is nothing in the bill or no provision in the bill that allows the Commissioner to establish rules and regulations and procedures in the application process. Basically, under this particular bill, assuming that a doctor will certify that the person suffers from the medical condition and that the benefits of marijuana outweigh the hazards, the health hazard, the Commissioner is mandated to issue the medical registry card. In our position paper, you'll note that there is a pretty broad definition of what is intractable pain. Now, it's been tightened up a little bit by the recent amendment that was brought before the committee today, but the reality is, and our experience has been in these other states that have had similar legislation, similar definitions, that the vast majority of these cards will not be issued for conditions associated with cancer, HIV, glaucoma, and other serious medical diseases, or to patients who are terminally ill. You take Colorado, which has a similar definition, for example. Over 4,800 patient registry cards have been issued. Less than 10% of those cards have been issued for those types of diseases, and over 87% have been issued for serious pain. So we have this broad definition, and then we have a legislation that really doesn't give the Commissioner of Health any authority to establish rules and regulations. And then the legislation allows for judicial review of a denial. And the question becomes is how is the Commissioner of Health going to defend their denial of any patient registry card? In fact, there's not even a requirement that the applicant submit their health records or their medical records in support of the application. That is nowhere in this particular bill. Those are the types of regulations that that concern us. In addition, you'll notice in the bill that there's the opportunity for the Commissioner of Health to inspect, for instance, these registered organizations. This bill allows individuals themselves to grow up with 12 plants of marijuana. It allows primary caregivers to sign up at least 5 patients. That's 60 plants of marijuana. And it allows registered organizations to exist which are capable of producing thousands of plants of marijuana, with the only limit being that they have to have a qualified patient signed up on the particular bill. We're looking at a growing operation that are capable of producing hundreds of thousands of dollars of marijuana. Obviously, that opens up the potential abuse. The only thing the bill allows is for the Commissioner of Health to come forward and inspect and recommend security procedures, but there's nothing in the bill that will allow the Commissioner of Health to come forward and establish rules and regulations to what those minimum standards are. And then it comes to questions, how does the Commissioner of Health try to enforce it? How does the Commissioner of Health try to shut down this particular operation that gives them concerns? There's nothing there in this particular bill. Another concern that this particular bill does, especially to law enforcement, is this bill opens up the likelihood of civil lawsuits against police officers, police departments, and state and local government. Let me give you an example of how these cases would commonly come forward. If the officer or law enforcement agency were to receive a report from a concerned citizen or some other individual saying that, hey, listen, I hear or I smell some marijuana, and maybe marijuana, the person next to me coming forward and from the apartment that I'm detecting. And then that particular report comes through, the officer does some additional investigation, maybe runs a dog, drug detection dog past the apartment, gets a search warrant in this particular case, they go into the apartment, they seize the marijuana, only to find out that the person had a medical marijuana card. Now, if they have a medical marijuana card, the police officer could contact the Commissioner of Health under the bill, but the Commissioner of Health cannot verify the existence or the validity of the card. They can issue that the card number was given, but the identity of the person. What's going to happen then is if it does subsequently turn out that it was medical marijuana, the officer is going to have to give that back under the state law, under the current state law, in violation of federal law, and in violation of ethical duties and responsibilities as law enforcement officers, or face a civil lawsuit for the value of the marijuana. That's a very, very difficult situation. We're looking at marijuana valued at $3,500 a pound in some cases. It could cause significant concerns. This is a concern that's already been identified by the state of Colorado in their process of trying to develop that particular situation. It has not been addressed in this particular bill. So we're going to be having lawsuits. We're going to be having the potential of state and local governments already in tight budget and tight resources of being forced to have to pay back this money or give back this marijuana, which is going to cause significant difficulties, as the Commissioner indicated, because of the violation of federal law. Those are just some of the aspects that we're concerned about. And again, our paper that we've distributed to you covers a lot of the additional public safety concerns that the Commissioner referred to. Thank you.
We're going to have to wrap that up because we have a few more that want to, their time is going to be shortened by that. And we're trying to deal not with the criminal aspects of the bill, which will be treated in Representative Hellstrom's committee. Mr. Pritchard, you're next. And we have six people after you in about 5 minutes, so could you try to, I'm sorry about my neighbor, but maybe we'll give you a couple minutes and then the others a minute or something like that.
Yeah, my name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and we oppose this legislation. We feel it's a bill that invites abuse. Not only is the definition very vague, which less than 10% of, as was already mentioned, in Colorado and California, other states, is actually used for serious terminal conditions. So it can be used for headaches, tennis elbows, and all sorts of things. Also, the unlimited supply. 12 plants of marijuana can produce upwards of 35,000 joints of marijuana. And under this bill, an 18-year-old boy can be growing this in his home, distributing it. And we're very concerned about abuse that's going to result from that. And we're also concerned about the message this is going to send to our young people in our community. They're now being told that marijuana is a medicine when, in fact, it's a dangerous substance. It really undermines the whole message we're trying to convey to our young people. And this, under this bill, this marijuana can be sold from neighborhood homes, storefronts, shopping centers. They can set up just sales places. And we just feel that this is really going to undermine and hurt our society. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pritchard. Jim Freuling, I believe. Hopefully about a minute.
My name is Jim Freeling. I'm just going to be real brief. I'm an ex-drug dealer, and from looking to the law enforcement aspect of this, I'm going to tell you basically what's going to happen. If it's legalized and the plants are out there, people like me or what I used to be will kick the doors in, get those plants, and put them on the street. And I'll keep it brief because I know you got more people, but that's all I got for you guys.
Thank you very much. Very, very good. To the point and quick. Jim Hassie.
Good morning, my name is James Hafer. I'm here to testify against this bill because I know the dangers of marijuana from personal experience. Marijuana, for me, is an addictive, destructive gateway drug. This bill opens the door wide to abuse by individuals and will only harm society. I began smoking marijuana at age 13. I became lethargic and melancholy by age 17 because I was smoking daily by then. I blew an opportunity to go to the University of Minnesota on a hockey scholarship because of smoking pot and drinking. My grade point average dropped significantly during this time. I'm 53 years old now, and I'm in a year-long treatment program learning how to live life free from drugs and alcohol for the first time in many years. And all of my drug problems started with marijuana. It was a gateway drug for me. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. From marijuana, I got into harder drugs, LSD, cocaine, heroin. And this bill will send the wrong message to impressionable young people that there's nothing wrong with marijuana because it's now a medicine. And it will open the door to further abuse by expanding the amount of marijuana grown and circulated in society. Smoking marijuana is anything but a medicine. I can sympathize with people who have serious issues. I've destroyed my own liver because of my lifestyle. But in my opinion, legalizing marijuana will open the door to far greater problems in people's lives. These problems far outweigh any benefits to the individuals. I've known thousands of drug addicts through my years being in jail and treatment centers, and every one of them, without exception, started with marijuana. In closing, this bill will put the safety and well-being of more people at risk than it will help. I ask you to vote against this bill.
Could you just spell your last name?
H-A-F-I-Z.
Oh, are you one of the St. Paul Hafises?
Yes.
Jim and Bob and...
Yeah, that's my dad.
Which one?
Bob.
Bob is
my dad.
Longtime client of mine from the old days. Ryan Rasmussen.
Committee, senators, I'm here. My name is Ryan Rasmussen. I'm just here to oppose this bill. I started growing marijuana, just a small amount to feed my own habit. And I seen an opportunity to make a large amount of money. And it took abuse me, and it ruined my life. And I'm just here to oppose this bill because of the amount that you can grow. And to have that much amount of marijuana on you, 2.5 ounces, is a large amount. And if they only say they need a couple puffs, and they'll be all right, and it'll relieve the pain, I don't see why they can have that amount on them. And to grow marijuana in your house, it ruined my life, and I can only see it ruining families and other people's lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There's a Sherry Wagner, Jim Stinziani, and Ann Johnson. Do they want to testify? We're just about out of time for this side. We try to balance off people of each side. State your name.
My name is Jim Stinziani, a veteran, born and raised in Minnesota. Went to the University of Sociology, Psychology. I think we have to look at the history of this whole marijuana decriminalization situation. There are certain individuals, drug cartel leaders, promoters, mega speculators, billionaires, for instance, a man named George Soros, and basically started in California. He funded the initiative to bring this to the population. It wasn't a grassroots operation. This was funded from the top down. Several institutions he funded, Drug Policy Foundation Society, Marijuana Policy Project, normal national organization for reform of marijuana laws, Transnational Institute. Just briefly, I've got information on this. If anybody is interested, look at the history. This is not just a medical marijuana, save pain and suffering, which everybody believes in. This is a top-down operation from the big drug lords. And by the way, I left this at your offices yesterday. St. Paul Pioneer dispatched a newspaper article where drug operations were investigated, and got 4 pounds of methamphetamine, 5.9 pounds of cocaine, 1 pound of marijuana, 7 guns, 10 vehicles, $33,000 in cash. This was in St. Paul, Minneapolis, Invergrove Heights, Shakopee, Bennett Heights, Roseville, Bloomington, Richfield, Oakville, and Wilmot. This is a top-down drug operation. Get your foot in the door with medical marijuana.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we'll open it up to discussion on the committee, and I want to explain that the discussion in this committee is not on the health. That was taken care of, and you've already been to Health Committee, and you're going to Public Safety, so the criminal aspects will be dealt with there. So, Representative Westrom.
I guess I'll ask the author this question, and maybe somebody else will need to answer, but two questions, Representative Rukavina. This allows, if I understand it right, 12 plants to be grown by a person that holds medical marijuana. A card.
That's right.
How do we avoid what some of the people said, that the door is being kicked down, or once someone passes away, those plants being discarded properly and not out on the street, if you will. And then I got a follow up.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, first of all, there's 13 other states that have this. And the reality of it is, I'd like to ask the law enforcement and the assistant attorney where they have statistics demonstrating that doors have been kicked down or anything else, because I don't have them, and I don't know of those instances happening. Can I ever guarantee you that it wouldn't happen? No, I can't guarantee you that it wouldn't happen. And as far as some of their concerns, I don't believe that they've ever come forward to work with us. I could be mistaken, but, last year they did, but this year is different, and no one's approached me this year to work on any other concerns, Representative Weston, but I just don't see it happening that way. And if I could address Mr. Campion's what statements that he made from a health perspective, saying that, there's no proof, that's absolutely not true. I think it's the American College of Physicians said they asked for marijuana in 2008 to be reclassified under federal law to allow physicians' prescription, citing, and I'm quoting from the study, now marijuana has proven efficacy at treating certain symptoms and its relatively low toxicity. As far as no medical association supporting it, the American Medical Association is neutral, and the American College of Physicians supports the use of medical marijuana, and I believe Most of the oncologists in the country, if I'm not mistaken, belong to the American College of Physicians. Thirdly, to Commissioner Campion about federal, you know, they're going to be running up against federal law. I believe it was just the other day that Attorney General Eric Holder said the Justice Department will no longer waive medical marijuana dispensaries in states where they're legal. And so I, you know, I guess as far as the Assistant County Commissioner, I just don't see anything that he said is being able to be addressed at all. He talked about the identity cards. They have to have a photograph on them. They have to have an address on them. Talked about, Mr. Picard talked about 12 plants. What did he say? I can't remember the amount he said of joints
that
you could get off of them, but it's largely exaggerated. So,
Representative
Weston, I don't know what to tell you as far as your specific question on breaking down doors.
Representative Rukavina, I think he's an assistant county attorney. I know the word attorney is hard for you to say.
What happened to the county attorney from that county? He used to come and testify on this, so where's he at?
Mr. Baxter is here a lot. Members, as I tried to explain before, Representative Hillstrom has this coming to her committee, and can we try to not get into the criminal as much, because she'll have a thorough, I'm sure, and she's nodding her head, she'll go into that thoroughly, the criminal aspect. So I'll try again on that.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Mahoney.
Well, Mr. Chair, I had a follow-up.
Representative Westrom, follow.
I had announced that even before I asked the question, but Mr. Chair, I mean, that presumes it does make it to Representative Hillstrom's committee, so it potentially could not pass out of here, and then she'll never have those issues to vet, so it gets to be a little constraining to not have some answers. But Representative, Rukavina, I'll try to lump two topics into one question, and maybe Commissioner Campion can respond as well. But to the federal issue, what you just said, I've heard that recently as well, and I'm wondering how that squares. The federal government is now saying they aren't going to enforce those laws in the states as they are. Just for the commissioner, how do we square that issue? And secondly, Representative Rukavina, I thought we had language in a bill last year that was more constrained or focused on having this coming through prescriptions, much like we would have morphine or other intense pain-restricting or pain-easing drugs in our medical fields right now. Why don't we rather go through the pharmacies and have a process where people can pick up prescriptions of this instead of growing your own if you have the right card?
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, last year's bill, I can't speak, but I think this bill is pretty much identical except for a few concerns that have been met. I don't think the federal government allows doctors to prescribe marijuana, but the attorney that's helping me here is nodding her head.
Thank you. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, could staff give me some idea of what the parameters of this bill and this committee should be? I mean, my understanding is civil penalties and data privacy, data practices.
And also there's some other stuff. I went through this last week, line by line, and unfortunately the notes are up
in your handwriting?
No, but I made notes beside it. Unfortunately, I tried to break it down by sections, and there's jurisdiction of this committee interwoven within paragraphs all through this. Unfortunately, I can't break it down by sections, but obviously the health issues and the criminal issues, which have been the two talked about, are not in this committee. The criminal is in Representative Wilson's committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I think looks like we're ready to vote. The motion is
Mr. Chair
says amendment. Representative Western.
Could we maybe get the commissioner to react to the federal issue and the state issue or not? Are we going to just pass pass it without...
Mr. Commissioner, or Commissioner Campion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Westcombe. It's my understanding what Representative Roccavina referred to was a memo from President Obama to Attorney General Holder. The fact of the matter is the federal law is still a federal law. That has not changed at all.
Thank you, Commissioner.
So we will still, to answer your question directly, Mr. Westcombe, we'd still be in conflict with federal law if this legislation passed.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for the Commissioner, we heard a number of issues that were brought up by law enforcement, and just to what Representative Roccavina said, has there been any amendments brought forth or any discussion to say if we cleared this up from a law enforcement side that we'd be okay with the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the answer, probably short answer, is no. As I testified, I think fundamentally the bill is, you know, it doesn't, won't accomplish what it's intended to, so for us to make minor changes, it seems fruitless to do that. I think probably the only substantive change that I've heard from the law enforcement community, and I can't be speaking for the whole community, is that if there was clear language that this focused on end-of-life treatment, it would put a more significant and legitimate focus of the legislature, but that's not there.
Thank you. Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd have a question for maybe anybody on the committee or Representative Roccavina. The very first section, Subdivision 21, looks at the classification of the data of those in the registry. Not knowing what 152.25 Subdivision 5 says and what that means in terms of the classification of data, I just have an open question about how is it being classified. And then maybe if it's protected, I guess the question as to why maybe that's not more open.
Representative Roccavina.
Mr. Chair, I don't represent the discussion. Where are you at?
I'm on page 1, Representative Roccavina.
In what line?
1.9 through 1.11.
Maybe I could have some help on that, excuse me. That refers to Subdivision 5 on page 8, Representative Petrosky, which deals with data privacy. Data practices, excuse me. Data and registration applications that you see on line 8.19, I believe, in Nixon Grossman.
For clarification, Representative Driscoll, there's a number of data practices that aren't in Chapter 13. So that, I believe, is one of the data issues that is not in 13.
I'm just curious as to how we're classifying this data as the bill is written.
Commissioner Campion, do you want to...
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I didn't hear the... I was conferring with the author here for a moment.
He wants a picture with me for a moment. Anyway. I told him as long as it doesn't show up in my brochure, Mr. Chair, I'm going to lose a vote.
I'd be happy to show up in Mr. Representative Roccavina's campaign letter to him, Mr. Chair.
Can we get a...
I didn't hear the question, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer.
Mr. Kraskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'm just curious as to how the bill is classifying the data in the Department of Health Registry. What this is. Okay, so it is classifying it as private data. Thank you, Representative Campion.
You show them page 8.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Campion.
So the follow-up to that is, what is the reason for classifying it as private data?
Representative
Roccavina. Well, Mr. Chair, that can be, the Commissioner can release that to, I believe, to law enforcement, but it's held as private data with the Commissioner of Health. And I suppose, why would it be public data? I don't know.
Representative Campion, did you want to speak to this?
No. Oh, well, I mean, seeing that you caught my name, I will say that it appeared to me that the reason why it would be private data is because it's medical, and usually medical information is private data.
Mr. Chair, and in addition to that, it cannot be released, as I understand it, to law enforcement, period.
Medical data.
Thank you. Okay, the motion again is to pass as amended and send it to public safety. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carry.
Thank you, members.
Representative Keith tonight. Not a single question. One
question.
If Bobby thinks I'm going to hear me around,
We are trying to conduct a hearing here. Would the noise quiet down? Okay, Representative Ethan, I called you before and I guess you didn't hear it. This is House File 722. Does somebody want to move it? Representative Mahoney beats them this time. Representative Mahoney moves 722, and this gets sent to tax this time?
Excuse me?
Representative Peason, does this go to tax?
Yes.
Okay. So the motion is to pass and re-refer it to the tax committee. Then Representative Peason, I believe you have an A3 amendment.
Yes.
Representative Mahoney, will you move that? Representative Mahoney moves A3 amendment to get it in the shape the author wants, is my understanding. So all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Peason, go ahead and explain your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill to expand on some legislation that we passed in 2003 that set the first standards in the country for tax preparers. And this is building on some things we've learned since then about some of the abuses in some sense that go on with some of the tax preparation services, and we're trying to tighten that up. We have worked with the Department of Revenue, and they've provided some suggestions to us. We've also worked with H&R Block, who has provided actually some really constructive suggestions, which were now incorporated in that A3 amendment. And basically, I think the focus for this committee, Mr. Chair, is on the right to rescind.
Because we have contract and
okay, well, I'll,
that includes,
right. I'll just run through it. Basically, what the bill does, it sets new standards in addition to the ones we currently have for tax preparers, primarily aimed at avoiding commingling of funds, so the tax preparers funds with the client's funds. It requires a written agreement now if you're going to do one of these refund anticipation loans. It does create a right of rescission of one day, so that if someone signs one of the loans, they have a day to kind of get back to tax preparer and say, I'd like not to do that and take the loan and pay for their tax preparation services in another way. It has some language on advertising, so that if a tax preparer is advertising in a foreign language, they need to provide forms or disclosures in that language. So if you're advertising in Spanish, you need to disclose in Spanish. If you're advertising in, you know, Hmong, you need to disclose in Hmong, but you don't need to disclose in Hmong if you're only advertising in Spanish. It's really just making some improvements on what we've learned from this state and other states about how these tax preparation services operate. And I guess with that, I would just open it to questions, Mr. Chair.
Are there any questions on this? Representative West.
Chair, Representative Peason, tax preparation services, is that a different name or a different group than CPAs who also do tax preparation services? And let me ask the second part of my question. Yeah. A constituent recently wrote me, and I'm still waiting for kind of the answer from some of the research staff, but they said their tax preparer, which I think was a CPA, and I, under your bill, we might be using the term interchangeably, but basically they had messed up on their taxes and written a number down wrong that resulted in him now having a penalty because of an underreported amount of taxes, and I don't remember the number. Instead of it being $7,500, they might have written $5,700 or something like that. And his question was, aren't they liable for any of that or not? According to him, it was clearly their mistake. Is there anything like that being addressed in here, or what's under current law?
Thank you, Mr. On the first question, CPAs are regulated separately, and so they're not covered unless they offer a refund anticipation loan, and then they'd be covered by those provisions in this statute. As to the other question, I honestly don't know the answer. I don't know if Mr. Elwood knows. I mean, as to what the CPA's liability is, I don't know the answer to that question.
Mr. Elwood?
Mr. Chair, members, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I can tell you that the Board of Accountancy, we work with the Board of Accountancy and also the CPA Society on these provisions. And the reason that in 2003 and continuing to through this these amendments today, proposed amendments, the CPAs have been excluded because they have their own regulatory structure. So the accountability really is through the Board of Accountancy and in some ways also through the society. So I think your constituent would have redress through a different forum.
Any other questions? Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question on the right of rescission. Just a one day, so the funds aren't distributed for that day. There's a reason why we didn't follow like a 3 day, like mortgages or something.
Representative
Keith. Mr. Elwood, if that's okay.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kelly, you know, it's kind of a balancing thing. The whole idea, if people really want to take the refund loans, the purpose of that is so they get their money a little more quickly than they would otherwise. What we found in many cases is that people don't, even with the disclosures and even with all the things we have in place already, frankly, a lot of people still don't realize they're actually taking a loan. And that's our experience. So, you know, we've struggled with the time period. Should we do 3 days? Should we do 2 days? But we figured, to be fair to the offering, which is really for people who really want the money immediately, we thought at least 24 hours would be at least some cooling off period, but not too much. So it's frankly arbitrary, but we thought it was at balancing the interests of the business and the client.
Hello, Mr. Chair. So the funds are held for that day and then distributed.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kelly, they're typically you don't get your even though the perception is you get your money, you walk into the tax preparer and you get a row and you get your money immediately. That's actually not true. There is a couple of days wait anyway. So this really isn't impeding very, very much anything at all, because they would be waiting that period anyway before they got the money. So.
Okay, the motion was to pass as amended and re-refer to tax committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And meeting is adjourned.